Two familiar themes there, concluding the first half of this concert by the Jerry Mulligan Concert Big Band. Mulligan was featured on baritone saxophone in Georgia on My Mind, while immediately before that came I'm Getting Sentimental Over You, with solos from Jerry Nywood alto, Seldon Powell tenor, and two of the trumpet players, Barry Reese and Bob Burridge. And incidentally, the number Jerry announced as perhaps a blues has actually got an official title, Out Back of the Barn. The band will be back for the second half of the concert in about 10 minutes' time. Meanwhile, here's part of a conversation I had with Jerry Mulligan a few days after the concert. We met in London, in Jerry's suite at the Savoy Hotel, only a couple of floors above the ballroom, where, as I pointed out to him, 60 years earlier, the bass saxophonist Adrian Rollini had worked in Fred Elizalde's band. Rollini's name was to crop up later, as you'll hear. But I started things off by raising that question of how rare it was for outstanding soloists to double up as composers.
Also, there are a number of soloists who were composers also, but didn't write very much. Oh. I know a number of players. For instance, Zoot Sims wrote two arrangements that I know of, and they were very good. Very, very good. He wrote one for Woody Herman's band and one for some other band I can't think now. Dizzy Gillespie, of course. I love the way he wrote for bands. I think that part of that is that you have to be enough of a masochist to spend the time writing, because writing is a painful process. Mm-hmm. And you get spoiled improvising when you have those choices to make. It's a split-second choice. You make it, and if you don't like it, you can change it. When you make that choice when you're writing, you're stuck with it. And it's a long, slow process, so I think that it wears down the patience of the usual player. But I don't think it really is unusual for the outstanding soloist to be also potentially an outstanding writer.
It's just to make a career of it, I suppose, that is rare, I guess.
Yeah, it's unusual to mix the two together, as you say. But there's another side of that also, which is also a personality quirk. I feel like a split personality. It's absolutely schizophrenic to do both. You know, one is a private inward thing, and the other is extroverted, outgoing. So, and it's also involved around people. And writing is a lonely thing. You know, you have to get used to the idea that you have to spend a lot of time slogging it up by yourself.
Because you were writing early on, because you were writing for Elliot Lawrence, mm-hmm. I think, way back, I mean, before Gene Krupa even. Presumably you started playing first, did you?
Actually, I probably started writing first. When I was very young and had my first piano lessons, I think I almost immediately started writing, you know, as a result of what I learned at the piano lessons. So I started writing very early, and they both kind of went together, you know. As I had the opportunity to study the one thing, I automatically tried to do the other. Mm. But my first professional jobs really were as a writer. I left school to go on the road with a band, not as a player, but as an arranger.
Did you play with the Elliot Lawrence band? I mean,
not in the beginning, no. When Elliot had the band at the radio studio in Philadelphia, I was an arranger for the band. Oh. And later on, when he went out and tried to conquer the big name band world, I played with the band for a while. In fact, Elliot had the idea that I should play with the band, and actually, we had two baritone players with the band. That was kind of an addition. And we had a small band within the band. It's too bad we didn't record more for that band, for my own for my own memory's sake.
Yes, and then a little later, you're in the Claude Thornhill band, which mm-hmm. I suppose was a pretty interesting band to write for.
Also as an arranger, later on there, too. It's kind of an odd similarity, because each one of the bands I wrote for, at some point, I wound up playing for. With Gene Krupa's band, I was an arranger, and got called into service when somebody dropped out for some reason, if somebody was taken sick on the road, or on one occasion they hired a new alto player, and after a couple of nights it didn't work out, and as luck would have it, I had my alto with me, and so I got stuck playing in the section for the whole tour. And although I didn't really like it very much, I learned a lot, because there were some very, very good saxophone players in the band. So I was forced to learn more about playing the saxophone than I had really thought about it up until then. Thornhill's band, the same thing. I wrote for the band for quite a while before I played with them.
Anyway, I don't think you started by playing the baritone, but you...
Oh, no.
The sound of it attracted you early, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Did you hear somebody in particular, or was it?
Well, the function of the baritone in all the bands always fascinated me. Also, there were some good soloists around then. Everybody thinks immediately of Carney and Carney's identifiable sound and his importance to the Ellington band. But there were players, we were talking about Adrian Rollini before, who played, I know, bass sax. It's quite different and all that, but Adrian Rollini was a remarkable soloist and used that register, that low register, in a very melodic way, which is a challenge in itself, you know, to be playing in a low register and to give the illusion of playing an octave higher, so to speak, because that really is what happens with a good melodic player. There's also Ernie Caceres.
Oh, yeah.
And I liked his playing very much. But then after I'd already started playing, of course, Serge Chaloff arrived on the scene, and he was a very fleet player and could really get around on the horn. But I think more than anything, the register itself attracted me, probably in the same way that if a young person is attracted to the stringed instruments and chooses the cello over the violin, you know, and say, why? Why choose the cello? It's cumbersome, it's awkward to carry around, and it's a pain in the neck on buses. But if you like playing in that register, then you're stuck with it.
A fellow arranger with the Claude Thornhill band was Gil Evans, although Jerry had actually got to know him before that. And Gil played his own part in seeing that Mulligan was in the right place at the right time.
I had gone back to Philadelphia for a while. Got a postcard from Gil saying, what are you doing in Philadelphia? Why don't you go back to New York where things are happening? And so I did, and at that time he had this room that was, you couldn't dignify the room with the name apartment. It was a basement room with the pipes showing, and it was a basement room behind a Chinese laundry on 55th Street near Fifth Avenue. And it had a back door that it opened out on kind of a courtyard, you know, you could see some weeds and things growing.
And a piano, I suppose. Yeah.
And a piano. It was a very large room. And for quite a while, I wound up staying there. I found furnished rooms and it was inconvenient running back and forth and I didn't like them. So I said, well, come stay here. And we took turns using the piano, took turns using the bed. And people were in and out all hour of the day and night. It was a wonderful time for us.
A piece you'll be hearing in the second half of the concert is a number Mulligan recorded quite a few times, with his quartet out on the West Coast, for instance, and with his first concert big band. It's a piece with an improbable title, Bwibida Bobida. I asked Jerry, did it have a hidden meaning, or was it just a nice name?
No, it reflects some one of the rhythmic phrases inside the piece. But I think the first version of that was for Elliot Lawrence's band.
Really?
I originally wrote it for his band.
Because you did it.
And then I recorded it with what did they call a prestige album when they finally put it out as an album. Of course, it wasn't an album. We made it. They didn't have the 33 and a third yet. But the band that had the two baritones and Alan Eager.
About 51 or something like that.
No, it was earlier than that. It was before I went to California. It was about 49 or 50. Anyway, whatever, that was another version of it. Brookmeyer and I might have done it with the quartet. I don't really recall. Hmm. And then...
Didn't you arrange a version for Kenton?
I don't think so.
Oh, maybe I've got...
Didn't think of that. I should have done
something else. Because you did some scores for Kenton.
Yeah, I did. I kind of racked my brain trying to find things to write for that band. I didn't really feel a rapport with the band itself, although the particular band that I wrote for was... The guys in the band themselves were very enthusiastic to have me write for it. But
it was a format almost, wasn't it? Presumably writing, in a way, you had to write in the style of the band, I suppose.
Oh, of course you do. You must. But there are certain limitations in an instrumentation like that I never could cope with. I don't really like to write screaming high trumpet parts.
It's a bit bombastic, isn't it?
Very. It is a band that's approach to music for me was much more vertical. But I always like things more horizontal that evolved in lines and counterpoint.
Horizontal lines and counterpoint. That, of course, was the essence of the quartet that you led, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I know that not having the piano, I think, was the exigencies of where you were playing, wasn't it, rather than a deliberate policy?
Well, there had been an attempt at a deliberate policy earlier on in New York. In fact, that band that we talked about before that we recorded, the first Bwee Bida Bwa Bida, at around that time, I had a band in rehearsal that really didn't need a piano, the way the rhythm section was set up. But it was an experiment and try at something. But when that happened at that little club that the Red Norvo group was coming in to take the place of Errol Garner.
Was this the Hague?
Or the Hague, Hague, right. So that was the exigency you were talking about. I didn't want to play on a little tiny upright piano.
Of course, and then we get the first of the concert band. When is it? About 1960, is it?
1960 it started, yeah. And that was much more based around the quartet idea. The orchestrations and the planning, everything about it was geared around Brookmeyer and I, the valtrombone and the baritone. The piano was a rhythm section, just the bass and drums. And that was the basis of most of the arrangements.
Because the arrangements were written by a number of people as well as yourself, weren't they?
Yeah. I wrote very little for that band. No, once I started the band, it was it became much more than I ever intended, a full-time job, being a band leader.
And how, I asked, did his present band compare with those he wrote for in the past?
As a general thing, it seems to me that my band now is able to execute complex music a lot easier than a comparable band might have done in the 40s. Other than that, what it really means is that there are very few places for players to learn the way that we learn. There simply aren't the opportunities to play with bands, and even if bands are not important economically the way they were 40 years ago, the young players that come along still want to play that kind of music. They need that. I think my band offers a unique opportunity for learning and for development of young players, because what my band is doing is different than any of the bands around.
Yes.
Which I don't even think about because I don't hear those bands that much. I hear rehearsal bands and I hear what various bands are doing. But most of those bands are doing a thing in common that was the thing I always disliked about the Kenton Band. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the influence that has survived, which is everything is loud. Everything is kind of at the top of the dynamic possibility. And what I do with my band is use dynamics. Dynamics in attack as well as in dynamics of volume. And as a consequence, I think that the players get a particular joy out of playing because it requires them to do things of a wide range of possibilities.
In jazz and blues, there's always been a tradition of building numbers around the rhythms of railway engines. Mead Lux Lewis and Duke Ellington, for example, both excelled at it. And Jerry Mulligan has written at least a couple of pieces of that sort. He's also well known for having a special affection for steam trains.
Yes, well, I think I got that from my father. We had all kinds of books around in his library that pertained to various engineering things. Some of his books I loved. We had on the Canadian Ports and Harbors for 1917, and catalogs of municipal hardware like traffic lights and sewage systems, and books on locomotives. So I knew a great deal about a lot of extraneous things. So I suppose I got that because I think on both sides of the family, my mother's side as well as my father's, they were connected with railroads.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, and I think my father's family, he was born in West Virginia because his father was with the CNO.
Oh, really?
The Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad that had its railhead out in West Virginia someplace. Yeah. So he was something with that railroad. And my mother's family, her father was an engineer on the Pennsylvania. So I came by it honestly.
Yeah.
And so as a kid, I got a camera and I was taking pictures of steam locomotives all the time. Yeah. Sounds an idiotic thing to be doing with a camera, but there it is.
Jerry Mulligan telling me why he's so fascinated by steam trains. And we're going to hear a practical, and by that I mean a musical, demonstration of that in the second half of this concert by Mulligan's Concert Big Band, recorded last summer during the Glasgow Jazz Festival. The audience applauds as Jerry steps forward to introduce his festival commission.